been president of the Atlanta Fed since 2007, a long career in banking, studied economics and political science at Stanford University. Very happy to welcome back to the Hayes Advantage on Bloomberg Radio, Dennis Lockhart. Good morning, Dennis.
Thank you, Kathleen.
So quickly, as Steve Matthews just pointed out, we're discussing with Mark Vintner, Wells Fargo out of Charlotte. This merger's big. As you watch it, as a policymaker, as you look at the region which you represent, your regional Fed district, what do you think?
Well, I look at it from a macroeconomic point of view. The transportation sector across the Southeast is a very important sector. I spend a great deal of my time in Atlanta, as you know. Delta Airlines is headquartered in Atlanta. So an upbeat view in the markets on these companies is in all likelihood good for the people on the street.
Certainly, I guess it always raises a jobs question, because when two companies merge, one of the things they do is they get rid of what they consider redundant workers. Although in such lean and mean times for airlines, they've gone through so much downsizing, you kind of wonder if there will have to be a lot of that and if actually some jobs won't be saved in the long run.
I tell you, every time I'm on an airplane these days, it is absolutely full.
Indeed.
And, you know, the chances of getting upgraded aren't so great any longer. So I think the demand for air traffic services is very strong. I don't have any particular insight into what the jobs outcome of a merger like this would be, but certainly it looks like airlines are operating close to full capacity.
Stanford University is something we have in common, and since I raised the point earlier, I just can't resist, particularly since we're in major football country. Auburn Tigers ranked number 7. What really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. Why not? Who doesn't follow sports? How Auburn could be the only thing standing between Alabama and a national title, right? Mm-hmm. But those our Stanford Cardinals did pretty well, upsetting the Ducks, huh?
Yeah, I was glued to the tube on Thursday night. I was supposed to be studying for a speech the next morning, you know, looking over economic data and all that kind of thing, but I couldn't get away from the game, so I watched it the whole evening. I'm a big fan of the Stanford Cardinal.
Yes, indeed.
Fear the tree, as they say, and the team really performed beautifully on Thursday evening. Here in Alabama, as you pointed out, this is big football country. It's virtually an industry here in Alabama. And the saying goes that, you know, there's summer, fall, winter, and spring, and then football season. There are 5 seasons here in Alabama.
We know we could give a shout-out to the president of the Philly Fed, Charlie Plosser, because we know he's a big Alabama fan.
Well, he grew up here in Alabama. He actually grew up in Birmingham. And so every once in a while, Charlie will have a homecoming where he speaks to a Rotary group or some economic forum in Birmingham, and I just sit back and let him do my job for me in the Southeast.
Dennis, let's look at the whole question of taper, because this is what everybody is trying to figure out, so we're just going to ask you up one side and down the other so people can understand better. Our listeners want to know, what are you watching when you're trying to figure out, is it time to say yes, raise your hand, we're going to start the taper, or it's still time to wait?
Well, let me frame that with 2 things that I think are the way I think about a decision that might be made in the future on tapering. First is the question, is the economy ready? And that's clearly a function of the data that we're following, the most important of which I think at the moment would be both employment data and inflation data. So there's a question of whether the economy is ready. And then the second question that I think about is whether the time is right. And that's at least partially a question of whether markets have been prepared and markets are aligned with the thinking of the Fed. That's a question of whether our communication has been effective. I don't think any decision we make is one in which we would invite some interest rate shock or major major impact on the economy just by virtue of making that decision. So I start with those 2 basic questions. The economic data are as I said, going to focus mostly on employment and inflation, both of which are pretty far from what I would consider to be the mandate consistent levels that the Fed is seeking.
That's interesting because you said on Friday, and Steve Matthews highlighted it appropriately in his story covering your speech, that tapering would be on the table. Consideration, I believe you said consideration of tapering should be on the table at all the coming meetings.
And I did say that, and that is my position. I think the December meeting is one in which some discussion of tapering could very well take place, and then you have January and March. So, yes, I think it should be on the table.
Well, let's take a look at a couple of specifics that you so clearly outlined. Your speech on Friday, you also said inflation's too low and it's not moving to the Fed's target of 2%. Should the Fed wait to taper the bond buying program until inflation begins to move back toward the target?
I'd like to see some movement toward the target. At the moment, inflation is stable but too low. That is to say, we're not seeing indications of disinflation, that is the slowing of the pace of inflation, not dramatically at least. And we are certainly not seeing any indication of deflation, which would be the outright falling of prices. But we're also not seeing inflation move up in the direction of the target of 2%. So it's sort of stuck there in a, to use a round number, in a 1 to 1.2% range, depending on which measure you use for inflation. Ideally, we'd like to see some movement in the direction of 2%. That would certainly give me more confidence that we are not dealing with some downside scenario that is just about to develop.
Because the thing about inflation is it tends to get in a certain range and stay there over time, absent some big shock. But so what if we get to the December meeting, you're in Washington, inflation is about where it's been. Would you say, well, we'll talk about it, but hey, guys, it hasn't moved up, and payrolls are growing. It hasn't moved up, so no taper yet. Would that be your position?
No, not necessarily. I think you'd have to take a number of things into consideration. I mean, this is a decision that is not based on any one single element, but it's really a composite of a number of things you take into consideration. I say if there is a key thing, and then it's confidence. Confidence that the economy and the outlook that I have, or that is the consensus of the committee, is in all likelihood going to play out.
Is there a measure of confidence that you watch closely, or is it an intangible?
Well, there are measures of confidence. The University of Michigan, for example, has surveys of consumer confidence, and there are other surveys of business confidence going forward. The Conference Board, for example, has a good survey in that respect. When I'm talking about confidence, I'm really talking about, as a policymaker, my confidence that the economy is going to more or less achieve the outlook that I am premising a policy decision on.
Does looking at what it is going to take for the Fed to taper, what are the targets or the dynamics? You mentioned inflation moving back toward the target, starting to move up a bit. But it also sounds like you're saying you want confidence in the economy. But with inflation in particular, is that a necessary condition or a sufficient condition? I think you're saying no, inflation doesn't have to be moving up depending on what other factors are doing. And I assume you're talking about jobs and unemployment.
It's a total picture with inflation supporting an outlook that we're going to be able to converge back to 2%, that the pickup in growth that we've been expecting that is likely to develop, and the employment picture will improve. I do want to emphasize and my remarks on Friday and my remarks here in Montgomery today will emphasize this, that we can change our mix of tools without necessarily viewing that as a form of tightening. Tapering, in my mind, doesn't have to be synonymous with tightening. The markets may react differently, of course, but I think the mix of tools has to be appropriate for the circumstances. Recently, of course, there's been a great deal of discussion of the enhancement of forward guidance. I think forward guidance can go a long way to adding some stimulus to the economy. So I wouldn't rest the tapering decision just 100% on getting in December or January or February or early March a specific indication in the data that we're closing those gaps.
If there's additional stimulus added in the form of forward guidance, in other words, let's say some people are talking about moving the forward guidance level for unemployment from 6.5% down to 5.5%, would it be possible, they're saying you've got different tools. You could say, well, we're tapering, but you know what? We're changing the forward guidance. So we're now saying we want to see unemployment at 5.5% before we move the key rate off zero. Is that the kind of thing you have in mind?
That's the basic idea that I think should be under consideration. And it's just changing the mix. It's not necessarily in any fundamental way changing what is a highly accommodative stance of policy, and I think probably should continue to be a highly accommodative stance of policy.
Now, economists basically are forecasting, we had a survey of 32 economists after the jobs report, 204,000 jobs created in October. Nearly half said the Fed will wait until March. Then there was, you know, some in January. Are investors being complacent in thinking tapering couldn't begin or won't begin until March, particularly when you're saying it's going to be under consideration at all the meetings as far as you have a role in it?
Well, I'm speaking for myself, of course, but I think it should be on the table at all the upcoming meetings. And there are a lot of considerations, and I don't think the circumstances rule out a consideration in December. The January meeting could turn out to be a little bit more complicated because, again, some of the fiscal concerns are going to be front and center at that time. But, again, I would not rule it out in any of the coming meetings.
How much did that increase of 204,000 jobs enhance your sense that, this taper consideration is close enough that, hey, putting people on notice, we're going to talk about it in December and at every meeting. How much difference did the jobs report make?
It helped a little bit in my case. The expectations were closer to 125,000 jobs, and that would have indicated, had we come in closer to expectations, an apparent softening of the job generation capability of the economy. A stronger number helps, but I'm very cautious about these things. I don't think you just take 1 month's number that is subject to future revision and necessarily draw final conclusions from that. The number was encouraging, and the revisions to previous months were also encouraging. So some of the apparent softening may have been reversed. We may be looking at a little bit better jobs picture. That is a good thing, but it is not decisive as far as I'm concerned at this point.
Will you confirm something for me that I think some people get confused about, that for the forward guidance on moving the key rate, the Fed has said 6.5% unemployment is the threshold. But that 6.5% unemployment threshold, does it or does it not apply to moving to start the taper of bond purchases?
No, they are quite separate policies. That's something that has perhaps not been fully understood by the public. But the 6.5% is a threshold for what many people call liftoff of the federal funds rate target, the policy interest rate. According to current forecasts, the consensus of the participants in the FOMC, that date is all in all likelihood in the second half of 2015. And some would have it later. That's quite separate from the decision to begin the wind down of the asset purchase program.
Dennis, is it fair to say that there is a predisposition at the Fed to do the taper when the time is right? Are you kind of waiting to walk through the door, hoping to walk through the door, end this emergency program and start moving to back towards normal?
There had been, of course, a lot of talk, a lot of noise around the expression QE infinity. And when the third quantitative easing or asset purchase program began, It was defined as open-ended. There was no final date given. But it was, in my mind, speaking again for myself, never intended to be a permanent fixture of monetary policy. It was more like a booster rocket, really, than something that would be part of the woodwork forever.
Steve Matthews, also driving over from Atlanta to join us as well.
You and a number of other Fed officials have talked about the inflation target and defending the 2% inflation target. What do you mean by that, and how do you do that?
Well, defending the target means having a policy in place that is stimulative enough that it's likely to see both growth and a rise in measured inflation. At any given decision point that the FOMC might be facing, we have to think about how we're doing relative to that side of the dual mandate, which is the inflation side. The public generally, of course, is most concerned with the upside risk related to inflation, but at the moment it's running too low. And we would like to see inflation rise to a healthier and steady level of around 2%.
Dennis, could defending the target mean increasing the bond purchases?
Theoretically, yes. The total stance of policy is what really matters. And the fundamental piece of policy is the policy interest rate. That is now at effectively zero and is likely to stay there for some time.
Back to a point I raised earlier, though. If inflation is below target and it needs to rise, then is tapering inconsistent with that, reducing the bond purchases now?
It's changing the mix of tools that are used, which, you know, relative to the situation. I don't think it's an inconsistency to contemplate tapering, at least to have it on the table for discussion, while at the same time trying to communicate that the stance of policy is going to remain very accommodative.
And is tapering then consistent with the point I raised before the break, that the Fed instituted bond purchases as an emergency program, what do you call it, a rocket booster? What the Fed is leaning towards is saying, hey, look, the economy's growing 1.5% to 2%. Jobs are growing. Unemployment's down. We are at that doorstep, just a question of walking through.
As I said before the break, it was not meant to be a permanent fixture of policy. The timing of when we would begin to wind it down or to adjust the policy, that remains to be seen. The committee will deal with that and discuss it in the coming meetings, and I'm not going to speculate what the decision exactly will be. But, tapering was a supplement to a fundamental policy of being highly accommodative with a low target interest rate.
Dennis, when you talk about the possibility of changing the mix in conjunction with tapering, would it be your idea that we could see tapering and at the same time some fine-tuning of the forward guidance, such as a change in the thresholds at the same meeting?
It's possible. I would be supportive of consideration of that, so that maybe as a companion with some tapering decision conceivable, we might enhance the forward guidance in order really to convince the public and convince the market that the environment is not going to change dramatically.
How close are you watching the bond market? We had a guest earlier today, Matt Miley from Miller Tabak in Boston, saying gets the sense that the Fed is talking about being data-dependent, economic data-dependent, but that the behavior of the bond market has been key to the dynamics here. Bond yield created some concerns. Boom, up at 3%. Fed backs off and doesn't taper.
Well, I've certainly been watching the bond market as carefully as I always do over the last several months. The reaction of the bond market in May and June was in some respects a surprise, or you might say it was unintended and unexpected. then the yields backed off a little bit with the September decision. So it's something we have to monitor, particularly for the reason that the housing sector, just to pick one, auto sector, which is important here in Alabama, are interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy. Their future may very well depend a little bit on where the longer term rates are. And for that reason, I personally follow them very carefully.
Balance sheet. Do you have any sense of how large the Fed's balance sheet can get to be before it comes a problem in and of itself and could force the Fed to shrink it regardless of the state of the economy?
I don't think there's a magic number to this. When we're looking at the long-term risks, or as we often refer to them, the costs associated with a growing balance sheet and a large balance sheet, you're really dealing, in my mind, in scenarios, imagining scenarios in which circumstances arise that might make the fact of a large balance sheet a difficulty of some kind, or the normalization of the scale of the balance sheet more problematic because of circumstances. I don't think there is a single number, really.
I don't know if this is like talking to someone about their family members so they can't really say anything. But, you know, people are wondering about the dynamics between Ben Bernanke leaving as Fed chairman and potentially Janet Yellen, the next Fed chair, coming in. And how is it, Larry Myer said on my show, former Fed governor, the best gift the Fed chair could give the new next Fed chair, Bernanke, would be to start the taper so the new Fed chair doesn't have to. On the other hand, people have said, but wait a minute. If you're coming in as new Fed chair, maybe you'd like to institute that policy yourself. Do you have any comments or thoughts on how that's affecting you all as you do these debates every meeting and look to the next ones?
Well, I'll rest on what I've said to similar questions earlier, and that is that I don't believe this transition has any material effect on the policy setting. It is, after all, a consensus process. The chair is an extremely influential party, but not a dictator. And so I think the committee itself would be inclined to largely ignore the transition and just look at the economy and at the other considerations in making any decision that's coming up.
You mentioned fine-tuning communication policy. From your point of view, with September, I called it in my little talk this morning the great September head fake, because the markets, a lot of economists, even if they thought the Fed really shouldn't taper quite yet, they felt that signals had been given in some speeches and other ways and not contradicted by the Fed chair. Did the Fed kind of get a little bit wrong? Did you all learn something as you use communication as a policy tool? How are you going to fine-tune it? What needs to be done?
Well, the recent survey of primary dealers, awarded the Fed a fairly low grade in terms of the quality of its communication, and that's obviously tied to the experience people had in September. I think it just, to me, it reinforces how important it is to do your very best to communicate clearly with a committee of currently, I think, 17, but typically 19. Each of us with independent voices, and we're encouraged to get out and try to educate the public, and that allows us the scope for putting our own views across. This can be confusing, I understand. You have a lot of people talking, and only the chairman or chairwoman, in the case of Janet Yellen, if she's confirmed, really speaks for the committee. The rest of us speak for ourselves, and this can cause some confusion. We have to, going forward, do our very best to communicate clearly.
What's your favorite thing about being president of the Atlanta Fed?
Well, other than dealing with the press, which, of course, I
always
love.
Always a delight.
being part of public policy at a time in which monetary policy is so important and so critical to the recovery of the economy is a real privilege.
Well, a real privilege to have you on our show again, Dennis Lockhart. Thank you so very much. Fascinating discussion. I think you really added a lot of value today, clarified a lot of things for our listeners.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Dennis Lockhart, President of Atlanta Fed.